TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Greg Palast, Who Won the War on Iraq? In Great Britain, the Tribune magazine named him the most important investigative journalist of our time. But in the U.S., where he was born, Greg Palast's report for BBC Television's Newsnight and The Guardian paper are all but banned. Palast's most recent book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, has been on the New York Times bestseller list for months. But Palast needs to maintain residence in London in order to do his investigative work. Palast has broken some of the biggest stories of recent years. How Catherine Harris rigged the 2000 election in favor of Bush by illegally removing African Americans from voter rolls, and how Bush stopped the FBI's investigation of the Bin Laden family prior to the 9/11 attack. In part one, you heard how George W. Bush avoided going to Vietnam by getting into the Texas Air Guard. Palast also named some of the winners of the war on Iraq, such as Lockheed Martin and the Carlyle Group. Now you will hear how the voter fraud in Florida was engineered with the help of a company that might run future elections in the U.S. The name is ChoicePoint. Also coming up is the Bin Laden-Bush connection. Here is Greg Palast.
Going back to this question of harboring al-Qaeda, you know, harboring terrorists, you know, whose terrorists are these? You know, going back, on Newsnight, which is my show, BBC Television, that Jell-O talked about, we ran a report which ran all over the planet, top of the nightly news, and not only Britain, but Europe, Asia, Latin America, about how Bush hindered the investigation of the Bin Laden family, Saudi Arabian financing of terrorist organizations, including al-Qaeda. Your California State University up here at Sonoma gave us a Project Censored Award, for, you know, censored story of the year, which is like being on the worst seller list. You know, it's like the news you're not allowed to have in America. So I thought I'd let you in on what you're not supposed to know, right? And one of the things we had was there was a lawyer with the State Department in charge of the visa section in Jeddah. And he said that a bunch of guys came to him for visas in Saudi Arabia, said engineers going to an engineering conference or for engineering training in the U.S. So he asked a simple question, okay, where did you guys go to engineering school? And they looked at each other and they said, we don't remember. So, you know, it's a little suspicious, visa denied. He's yanked aside and told, no, you stamp those visas approved. See, because those guys work for our guy, an engineer, a real engineer, named Osama bin Laden. And we're taking them to the United States for counter-terrorism training. See, this was during the Reagan-Bush era, right, when Saddam Hussein and Osama were our friends. This was Saddam Hussein, remember, when Condi Rice said, how could we have left this, how it was immoral to leave this butcher in Baghdad for 12 years, the last 12 years. Excuse me, Condi, he's been in office. He's been the butcher for 24 years. See, but the first 12 years, he was our butcher where we got our chops, right? And this is before, this is before the Axis of Evil, when Saddam was facing down the evil Iranians, who are, you know, the unicycle of evil at the time, right? So, so Osama and his merry band came out of the Bush family Frankenstein factory. And it's interesting thing about terrorists is that, see, they always come, is that the terrorists are like homing pigeons. They come home to roost, see? And that's what we're looking at. We're looking at what the intelligence agents told me they call blowback, right? You know, we've moved. One of the other stories I had in there is about that you'll see in the new edition is about how Saudi Arabia moved $12 billion to Saddam to build his so-called Islamic bomb. Then, when he went renegade in '91, they moved it to Pakistan. They moved the money to Pakistan. He never completed the bomb, and he moved his money to Pakistan. See, we allowed him to have that money until he went renegade. We moved it to Pakistan. We don't have to. Colin Powell talks about how We can't allow some maniac dictator with weapons of mass destruction to threaten the planet. I thought, hey, we're going to invade Pakistan, right? Because that's where the money went. We don't have to send in inspectors. Musharraf, the dictator there, has exploded his atomic bomb on television, right? And you'd think that we would have maybe a bit of concern about this, another maniac with a weapon of mass destruction. Instead, we have our president taking pictures with the guy with his arm around him like they're going to the prom together, right? And so mark my words, write this down. Greg Palast said this, just like with Saddam. 12 years from now, President Jeb Bush is going to tell us that we have to go into Pakistan to get rid of the killer of Karachi, right? After he incinerates Delhi. See, because that's what happens when you create the Frankenstein. So we're creating more. And one other thing that I showed on television in Britain, and since I'm going to have to show it, I'm going to have to like go house to house to show you this because I can't put on TV in the U.S. But on television, a document marked secret at the top. Can you see that? So you can verify this. Like, do the Vanna White thing. See, secret. And it says I-199, which means national security, and WF, which means Washington Office of the FBI, national security document. By the way, if there's any FBI agents here, I've got your document. But don't come up after. And people are always asking, how do you get these documents? In this case, it was kind of interesting because we actually had some guys come to our offices, our researchers in Washington, and they came up, they asked us some dumb questions, and then when they left a file on the desk. Call back. They call us up, and they say, we left a file on your desk. You haven't looked at it, have you? You know, me? Right? And then they said, well, so we'll be back in a half hour to get it, unless you need 45 minutes. Right? So maybe they want us to see it. What it is, it's a document which shows that it's a simple document calling for a reopening of an investigation which had been mysteriously closed, but now it's quickly opened, September 13th, 2001, of a suspected, what they call a suspected terrorist organization, which means like Cody's Bookshop or something, but actually these guys were pretty nasty that they were looking into. It was the organization that ultimately, one of their people was the conduit for Osama bin Laden's little tapes to America, you know, and a nasty little operation. I say, but why weren't they investigated? This is what we pay the FBI to do when they're not chasing, you know, pie-throwing anti-globalists. This is what we pay them to do. And actually some of the agents thought this is what they were paid to. Why couldn't they? Well, who is it that they were told that they could not investigate? It turned to page 2, and there's a funny name there. Bin Laden, not Osama. See, Osama we've always been going after. He's the black sheep, right? But the Bush family keeps telling us that the rest of the Bin Ladens are white sheep. We know that because they fund the Bush family enterprises, see, like Carlyle Group. Their financier financed George W.'s very lucrative but failed oil companies, right? So this is not about that George Bush knew about September 11th in advance, you know, that he didn't warn anyone. This is not what our investigation is finding. This is all about the money poisoning, the oil contamination of foreign policy. I mean, we don't have evidence. I don't have, maybe someone else, I don't have any evidence that George Bush knew in advance about September 11th. In fact, it's interesting because, you know, Cynthia, one of the people that has always read my reports and was a Congresswoman, Cynthia McKinney, who used to, you know, read all my British stuff and write me constant emails asking for information. She stood up many times and started saying that someone ought to investigate these reports on BBC television and the Guardian newspapers. And then the New York Times, National Petroleum Radio, and the Atlanta Journal said that she had said that George Bush knew about September 11th in advance and wouldn't tell anyone, right? Very interesting in all the news that fits to print New York Times, because I called them up and I said, where did she say this thing? Because she said she didn't. She just called for an investigation of these intelligence failures, which seemed to be influenced by Bush family. You know, you can't look at the Bush family friends. That's what she was asking. says, so where'd you find the quote that she accused Bush of knowing about September 11th in advance? And the New York Times reporter said this, and I happened to have my tape recorder on at the time. Well, the quote, that statement was all over the place. And I said, well, BBC needs a little more information. National Petroleum Radio said, oh, we know where it came from. It came from this, you know, kind of wacko show called Flashpoints on Pacifica, Dennis Bernstein, right? And if you look at the transcript, no such thing, right? Well, what the hell? By the way, the United States of America is the only place which has a First Amendment, the right to freedom of press and of speech, a right. And the Britain, there is no Bill of Rights, there is no constitution, no written constitution in Britain. And I don't have the freedom of press there in the law. You know, I report there. I can report things there that I can't report here. But what I have to do is I do have to face official censorship of the Official Secrets Act, a libel law which is akin to basically corporate censorship. You are guilty till proven innocent there. Very interesting and pretty grim. It only applies to journalists. I'm not kidding. I'm not making that up. And so I have been campaigning very hard, as you'll see in the book, for Britain to have a First Amendment right of free press and speech. And they can borrow ours because we're not using it, right? But we still haven't answered the question: who has won the war on terror and the war in Iraq? And Forbes magazine said for the war on terror, the winner is, they said, we don't know who's lost the war on terror, but the winner is, this is from Forbes magazine, the winner of the war on terror is a company called ChoicePoint. So now that rang a bell, ChoicePoint, okay? To understand who ChoicePoint is, you have to go back, like it or not, to the presidential ordeal of November 2000, okay? And I have to say, I know you're all saying, move on, Greg. But I'm going to just move you back for a minute because you have to know, you can't know what's happening now until you know what happened then. Because ChoicePoint has won the war on terror, and you have to know who these guys are. Back in 2000, November 2000, day after the election, I'm off my show for the night, taking the night off. Michael Moore's on instead. Yay. I love Michael. And, you know, that's how I get my stuff in the U.S. And when I can't get it on the air, I say, give it to the fat guy in the chicken suit. Right? that's how we get. No, seriously, if it weren't for Moore, I wouldn't, he's kind of kicked in the electronic Berlin Wall for me. So I'm watching BBC, and there's like one black face after another coming out to the cameras from Florida saying, I tried to vote, I couldn't vote, you know, my name wasn't on the list, they wouldn't let me vote, I didn't know, right? I said, okay. And I said, in that conspiracy nut mind of mine, if you saw Politically Incorrect, you know that I've been called a conspiracy nut, right? Which always gets a laugh from the conspirators, right? And I was thinking that there is like some type of computer program that's reaching in and erasing black voters from the voter rolls, right? That's what's happening. There might be some computer program. So I have the program right here, see? Here it is, and which I got out of the offices of Secretary of State Catherine Harris. Okay, this is it. For those of you, this is an Excel spreadsheet that's been, like, we got shiny, you know, CD-ROMs. I had volunteers, good geeks who cracked this for me. By the way, I need a lot of volunteers and help, so please, I have an email list, a sign-up sheet. I want you all to sign up tonight, not just, you know, buy books, that's nice, but I want you to sign up to participate, okay? The list will be, God knows, but as you walk out, we'll have, where I'm signing books and stuff, we'll have a table where you can put your name and email address and we'll make a copy for Mr. Poindexter. What you have to understand is what this list is supposedly, this is a list of 57,700 names of people that were expunged, marked for purging from the voter rolls of Florida 5 months before the election. 57,700, one of four, this is the first of four lists, as it turns out. And supposedly these are people who are not supposed to, they're people who are not supposed to vote in Florida because they are criminals who are, if you're a felon in Florida, if you've committed a crime in Florida, you can't vote. You lose your citizenship, right? Okay, that's a disgusting rule, but it is the rule. But, so I looked at who are these ne'er-do-wells. And you look down the list, and let's see if I can find. Okay, here's one. Thomas Cooper. And it has a conviction date. Wait, January 30th, 2007 is when he's convicted. You know, it's like Minority Report. You know, it's like, I'm thinking, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, Catherine Harris, detective of the future, you know, goes in, finds the bad guys and brings them back. You know, you can't vote in Florida. You know, it's like she's like Santa Claus. She knows who's going to be good and bad. And there's 500 criminals of the future in here. The election was decided by 527 votes. There, on this list, 90.2% of the people on this list are innocent of any crime. Okay, except if you look on the rest, on the right side, look at these. W-H-I-B-L-A-B-L-A, W-H-I-B-L-A-B-L-A. The voter's race is right next to the name, and 54% of the people on this list are innocent, except that they're black, voting while black. Just this list cost Al Gore 20,000 votes net. That's your election. So was it deliberate? Was it a goof up? What was it? So I'm looking. I go back into the Florida Department of Elections electronic email system and get the emails, right? And sure enough, there were clerks who said, my God, we're removing the civil rights of people who are convicted in the future? What do we do? Well, you know, I went to L.A. public schools. I figured you just give people back their right to vote, you know, but that's too simple. So it turns out what the Republicans in charge of the office said was, if you blank out the conviction dates, no one will know. See? So 4,000 blank conviction dates on this list, convicted no time. Okay. You know, I did report this, by the way, within 3 weeks of the election, Al Gore was still in the race in Britain. Okay, in Britain. And the Washington Post did let me run part of that story under my byline 8 months later when Bush could read it from the White House. Very difficult to get in. You know, the journalism of fear. Even Salon.com, which brought part of my story over, censored and removed the second part of the story, which was finally printed in Harper's a year later, and we've just been nominated for the Magazine Pulitzer Prizes for it, the National Magazine Awards. I mean, it's difficult, you know, in the U.S. The trained subservience is very difficult to overcome. But the question is, you know, who came up with this rotten little list? Well, first there was a company that was paid $5,000 a year to hunt the nasty illegal voters, and they were fired. And the highest bidder was given the award. Instead of $5,000, they paid $2 million. Choice Point, the new winners of the war on terror. Because they picked our president, and now he's picked them. It's a nice deal. You know, you've read that in the Chronicle, right? So one of the interesting things is I went to Choice Point. I said, why $2 million? And sure enough, I find a document marked secret and confidential. I feel like McCarthy. You know, I've got a document here. The difference between McCarthy and me is I've got the document. Take $2 million. The excuse is that they're going to make what says here on their that they're going to be paid $2 million for the manual verification using telephone calls. Okay, why is that secret? So what about these telephone calls? Yeah, I mean, I have experts here. Mark Swedland, who's in this area, an expert in the area, said, you know, it's this important. You actually make thousands of phone calls to verify the information before you remove people's civil rights. So there's people, Jane Doe, Jesse Jackson in here, Thomas Cooper. There's 76 Thomas Coopers in the phone book. Even if that guy wasn't convicted in the future, how do they know they got the right one? You make these calls to verify. It's expensive. I called the company in Atlanta and I said, okay, give me your call list. Who did you call? I want to, you know, look at the calls. They said, there is no call list. I said, what do you mean? They said, well, we didn't actually have to, like, dial telephones to make these calls. And I'm thinking, well, see, now here in San Francisco, you kind of understand that, right? It's kind of like a New Age thing. It's like, you know, calling without dialing the phones. And see, I'm trying to get my head into this space. And I'm listening to this guy. And I'm thinking, I'm thinking, okay, I got a Welsh producer. He said, forget it, call Catherine Harris, right? And Harris sets us up to get the answer. She sets us up with her Department of Elections chief, a guy named Clayton Roberts, a little kind of beady-eyed, red-faced guy who does, he's actually a Harvard Law graduate who does all the thinking for Kate, see? And he's in charge of the election process in her office. So I sit down with him, and I'm about to show him, you know, BBC cameras are rolling and polite, and I'm about to show him the document, and he sees that it's the one marked secret confidential. He knows what it is. He takes one look, and he rips his microphone off his lapel, does a 50-yard dash across the camera wires, locks himself in his office. I'm chasing after him, right? And calls in the state troopers to remove me and my camera crew from the state building. Okay, I know what you're thinking, but actually maybe just had another appointment, right? And now here's the interesting thing. While I'm filming him, PBS cameras are filming me. They're filming me filming him. It's very postmodern, right? And PBS is following me around. Okay. But this creates a huge problem for PBS because despite their long tradition in history, and I know I'm on the hallowed grounds of Lowell Bergman, so I'll make an exception for him, but despite Lowell Bergman and their strong traditions, PBS now has a problem because they now have actual real investigative reporting footage. And what are they going to do? So they had another problem, which is that they had assigned and paid a great director, many Emmy Awards, Danny Schechter, to do a film of the election process and what happened after Florida. And so Schechter says, great, look at this guy, you know, to explain why the guy's running away. He shows talks about the black voter purge, the list, the evidence, choice point, and he gives it to PBS after the inauguration, says, here's your film. And they say, well, maybe we shouldn't put it up on the satellite. Maybe it shouldn't go out as a network program. So to overcome the difficulties that the network, PBS network, has had, Danny and I have made several thousand copies of the film. You can actually get this, the Roberts run, if you wish. Besides the book, you can get that and show it. You know, show it to your Republican cousin in Utah. Every time he tells you to get over it. So choice point winning the war on terror. But you almost saw this. I do want to tell you, on CBS television, Dan Rather's operation called me and said, listen, that's really cool about, you know, the black voter, all that stuff. Can you give us a piece of that story you haven't run yet? I said, yeah, sure. You know, I don't care. I want the information in the U.S., even though you're a competitor. Jeb Bush's office was involved, not just Catherine Harris. His office sent out a letter 6 weeks before the election barring the registration of legal voters, almost every one of them Democrats. It affected about 50,000 voter registrations, almost everyone a Democrat. Okay, it's a little technical, a little difficult. Technical, difficult. I said, don't worry, Dan can read it off the card. And I said, you have to do but you know, there is a problem. You have to do a little work, you know, like Maynard G. Krebs work. I said, a little work, because I have every word of the letter. I'll read it to you from two separate reliable sources, from in Jeb's office, another source. But you'll have to go find the physical letter or get more evidence that it was sent out. And he got a story. He said, wow, terrific. A week goes by, and there's no story on CBS. Okay. I call him up. I say, what happened to the story of Jeb Bush barring these legal Democratic voters? And they said, well, Greg, your story didn't stand up. Okay. I said, you know, billion-dollar CBS operation. What do you mean it didn't stand up? It didn't stand up. And the answer was... how did you find out? What investigation did you do? And they said, well, we called Jeb Bush's office, and, you know, he denied it. His office said he didn't do it. There is no such letter. I said, Okay, but the Guardian was not so satisfied with that answer. They thought, despite the exhaustive investigation by CBS, we keep looking. And what happened was that I was trying to get the letter, having a little trouble until Harper's Magazine ran this story, got a letter from Catherine Harris, went on and on and on and on. Greg Palast is twisted and maniacal. But he's not wrong. We targeted all these thousands of black voters. Isn't it a shame? But it's not my fault. Everyone told me to do it. The Attorney General of the state legislature, and I got a letter from the governor. Huh? I call up her office and I say, listen, this. I don't say this is Mr. Twisted Maniacal. I said, I got a letter from this from Catherine Harris. And I'm sure the Secretary of State wants me to have this letter that she references in her letter. She says she got a note from the governor. And I'm sure, I said, I'm sure she wants me to see it. So could you check her files? I think the letter is dated September 18th, 2000. Could you send that to me? 10 minutes later, they faxed me this. There it is. Dan, so, you know, the closing thought is from your president, who did say, and I think these are good. This is one thing we agree on. He said, do not, your president said, do not fight for a dying regime. It is not worth your life. So thanks, and I'll talk to you, sign books. We're running late downstairs. Jello Biafra, thanks a lot. Glad to be home. Thanks, I'll be downstairs.
That was Greg Palast, author of the best-selling book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and investigative reporter and filmmaker for the BBC. His work has a huge, devoted following in Europe, but is not shown in the U.S. mass media. That's why Greg Palast, who was born in Los Angeles, maintains a home in London. He spoke at an April 2003 stopover in Berkeley, California. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Greg Palast on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this program with Greg Palast by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.